So we're now going to have some time for questions, and hopefully some of the things you were talking about, you can draw Mark and John into the conversations, the very animated conversations you were having with your neighbours. But I just would, just small reminder, that we are recording this, and we will put it on the internet so that obviously lots of people, other people can benefit from listening to Mark and John. So if it's something that you don't really feel comfortable about having on the internet, just bear that in mind and perhaps catch them at the end of the session. I think we also need to move these microphones around. Is that right? Yeah. So before you ask your question, if you could just wait till the microphone gets to you. They don't all have to be questions also. I think comments and contributions are very welcome. So I just wondered, who wants to sort of start? Great. Well, why don't we take there's three questions, and we'll take them in groups, and then that gives you a chance to thread some of the themes together. So there was you behind you as well. Yeah. Okay. And then you. Yeah. That's right. You put your hand up. Okay.
I'm going to make one statement and questions because I won't get the mic again. I think. My first thing was that I've been on the 8-week mindfulness course at the Oxford Centre after having been a Buddhist for many years and got to the stage when I was an occasional meditator and attender at Quaker meetings, and then went on the course and find it absolutely spurred me on, and I thought it extremely good. But I really feel that this business about the morality side, you know, the Buddhist approach is generosity first, secondly morality, thirdly mental training. And the morality thing is the five precepts, which are put positively: respect for life, respect for work and property, honest and straightforward sexual relations, not lying and truthfulness, and not angry speech, and keeping away from drugs and drinks which cloud the mind and lead to irresponsible behaviour. Surely, when our leaders talk about a moral compass, do we need any more than that? And is it not something which can be shared with everybody? And why do we have to be frightened about raising that and going a bit further than talking about meta for yourself, which is very important, but how can you have meta for yourself if you're a beast to your neighbour or stealing his goods? That was the first thing. Yes. The other thing was just slightly more abstruse, as it were, is that I think we're getting to the point where we're describing religion as a system of mental and moral training. Buddhism falls very easily into that as a definition. You, as a Christian priest, how do you find it for you?
The heart of Christianity, there's a practice, but over the years it's got surrounded by a lot of verbiage. So Jesus wasn't a Christian, just like the Buddha wasn't a Buddhist, and Christians have spent a long time denying who Jesus was. And almost as soon as a great religious leader or a wisdom teacher has lived and died, there are stories surround that person, and some of which are helpful and some of which I don't think are helpful, some of which are helpful in one age and not helpful in other ages. But the heart of, I think, all the great religions, Christianity is one of them, is, and certainly expressed in Christianity, self-giving love. Even self-emptying love. there's a Greek word, kenosis, which actually means, as you know, to empty. And that for many of the early church, summed up what they had experienced, first hand and then second generation. They thought the end of the world was coming, and a lot of that dictated how they behaved and what they thought. And then when it was clear the end of the world wasn't coming, they had to sort of adjust to life as it is. For me, I think mindfulness can restore the roots of any faith, can nourish the roots of any faith, including Christianity, Judaism, Islam. It has the advantage that in its original form, it didn't seem to be theistic, so it's not a clash, although for many Christians it is a clash, and they wonder what on earth we're doing dabbling in Buddhism. The other thing that mindfulness can help, I think, with if you have a practice of a religious practice, if it's a Christian practice, which is my own particular tradition, is that it can help unlock the key to many of the texts. Because we have split into subjective and objective in quite an unhelpful way, as we have invented a language-based religion in which doctrine becomes more important than practice sometimes. What you believe and getting it right is more important than the quality of your life and your relationships with yourself and with others. And the people that originally wrote many of those texts, which the Christians use, the Old Testament and the New Testament, actually didn't have this splitting between subject and object. And classically, for example, the fourth gospel, St. John, is all about trying to reunite two realms. So the earthly realm, called the cosmos in the Greek, and the heavenly realm, above and below. Mistranslated very often, like being born again. Actually, it's really meaning born from above. It's actually a uniting of two realms. And so the miracles, which are never called miracles by John, always signs. Sign is always pointing to something beyond itself. He calls them signs. Like water into wine was about reconciling two realms of experience. And as you read the text, you can read the English words, or if you're lucky enough to read the Greek, you can read the Greek words at one level. If you've done a bit of mindfulness practice, suddenly you discover other things, other layers within it, and it lights up something, and you suddenly discover, so that's what actually meant. Something is discovered. And I think, therefore, mindfulness comes in as a practice, it comes in as a corrective to the language base, it comes in to remind us how much in any organised religion you can really get things wrong. It's a bit like, you know, there was once a river running in a broad valley which everybody came to draw water from and was life-giving for the whole of the territory. And then somebody discovered that because it was so good, they culverted it and put a concrete pipe around it. And then they said, come to get the water from here. And suddenly the water dried up in this verdant valley. And the valley got drier and drier. But you had a lot of water. But it now is just running through the pipes with people standing guard saying, if you want some water, you've got to do what we say. You've got to stand up when we say, sit down and say, sing hymns when we say. Mm-hmm. And you can get some water from that source. And then now people have had to dig very deep by themselves in the valley to actually find water. Seems that what mindfulness is doing is releasing the water back out and saying, look, you can get it for yourself. And the danger is that we don't reinvent a church. That's the main danger now, that we don't reinvent. You know, people keep asking me, could we have a mindfulness association? I say, what do you want one of those for? Because you'll need a discipline committee and an ethics committee. Let's not reinvent the church. Let it be a movement, I think, not a sect or a cult. Sorry, I probably said too much already.
There was a gentleman behind, yeah.
I was wondering if you could say a little bit about perhaps the negative aspects of mindfulness. In the tradition, particularly the Theravada tradition, you get this idea of the dukkha-jnanas, where a meditator basically, in order to kind of go to deal with suffering, has to go through a lot of suffering. But, and it seems to me that Western Buddhism and the mindfulness tradition in therapy doesn't necessarily take into account the fact that you basically have to deal with a lot of suffering before you get out of it, actually. You know, so you get dragged through fear, misery, disgust, desire for deliverance, all these kind of things. And one of the things we talked about, and perhaps addressed, in, I suppose, people who might be vulnerable to those things.
John.
Yeah, John, do you want to? Especially, John, the way that mindfulness gets linked into the happiness movement, you know, Action for Happiness. That was I went to the launch of that, and that was very disconcerting.
Okay, well, I mean, they might not get talked about, I think, in what you're calling or referring to as Western Buddhism or in the mindfulness movement, but I think any meditator knows. If you stand close to your experience, you're going to get a lot of stuff you don't want. Mm-hmm. I've always been surprised, for example, that GPs have got slightly the wrong end of the stick. I mean, I used to be working down in Devon, running one of the centres down in Devon, and we used to get regularly sent to the retreat centre, people with, you know, severe problems, being sent to a meditation retreat to relax. And I've often been astonished that that equation is made, because actually, as you rightly say, I mean, within the tradition, you open yourself up. This is basically what you do. It's really literally taking the cap off, the lid off a whole can of worms, which are going to pop up. And meditation, as anybody knows who doesn't, and I think this is, I don't think we need to mention it really in many senses explicitly, because if you start to explore, then you get it. You know, you certainly, as I've often kind of mentioned to people, you know, if you want to really see greed, aversion, and delusion, don't switch on your television, just close your eyes. Yeah, you don't need to go there, because you're going to get all of this stuff. This is what our minds are doing. Now, some of it is going to be, you know, more pleasant. There's going to be an awful lot of unpleasantness there. But it's that ability, I think, of turning towards that unpleasantness and actually recognising it for what it is. And in a sense, learning in that acknowledgement to take a friendlier stance towards it. And actually to realise, and I think this is one of the phrases that's come out, this certainly sticks with me in the mindfulness movement, which I think is a really good phrase, which is actually thoughts are not you. You know, no matter how nasty that thing is running through your mind, all this dukkha-jnana stuff that's coming up, it isn't you. You know, and that slightly distantiated stance is such an important stance that we take, you know, both within the more secular clinical uses of mindfulness and within the Western Buddhist Vipassana tradition, for example, which is one I teach within, is that, you know, that distantiated position that you take up is actually so different from thinking. Doesn't sound a lot, but it's so different from thinking, because you're caught up in the thinking. This is watching that train. But still, what you're watching is a really kind of heady mix of pleasantness and unpleasantness. It really is that.
There was a gentleman, yeah, let's take several questions to see if you get more of a chance to contribute. There was a gentleman first. Okay.
What you're saying is that sometimes the pain is in the very resistance that you're putting, keeping the lid down.
Yes.
That is.
Have you got a microphone? Have you? Okay. It's just that we're trying to record the session, so if you could. Yeah. It's okay. There was a.
Can I just respond to that? Because I think that you just made a very important point here, because actually, the resistance and the amount of, if you like, I don't particularly like speaking about energetics, but the amount of energy that gets caught up in resisting stuff that actually at some point in time you're going to have to be confronted with or are going to confront itself. I mean, that's such an important thing.
Yeah, thank you for helping me to crystallise something that in my mind. I had the experience of doing the 8-week course, having attended 7-day retreats at Gaia House before. And though I think there's something very useful about teaching mindfulness and meditation out to the community, I felt there was something missing. Now, the obvious things were about the setting and surroundings, but I think there's also something about compassion, and I don't mean by that the person leading the course wasn't a kind person, wasn't a warm person. She was both of those things. But the people who teach at Gaia House really have a great deal of experience in speaking to people, both one-to-one and in groups, who are learning meditation at the early stages. And, I mean, the first 8 years of meditation are difficult, let alone the first 8 weeks. It seems to me that there is perhaps a danger that people who don't really understand the huge gamut of issues that people go through in trying to understand what they're experiencing, the difficulties that they're having, is perhaps not something that would come, perhaps, I mean, I don't know that much about the training that somebody does before they get to lead one of these courses. So it's really about that, whether compassion, that kind of compassion, by which I mean the kind of suffering with somebody, actually really feeling them, rather than the kind of typical therapist, client, psychologist, patient relationship, is such a different relationship.
I think it's a really good issue about the training issue. In mindfulness meditation teaching, as well as therapy, the longer you've been doing it, the better you're going to be at it, I think. Mm-hmm. And if you've got good supervisors, and there are now guidelines for how what you need to do to be able to begin to teach, they're not guidelines for a good teacher, they're just beginning to teach, and they're guidelines for trainers on how many to train, because the health service requires these things to be out there. But if you've done more of it under supervision and in a collegial way, as the teachers at Gaia House have been doing for many years, then you'll get good quality. Now, in teaching teachers as I do, and John and I do, there are often, we find, two barriers to people learning how to teach skills and mindfulness. One is if they've been a very experienced clinician, and therefore find it very difficult to see the difference between working with people as a bit of an agent of change and sitting alongside them and encouraging them to do their own work of mindfulness. The second barrier is if they've sat in many, many retreats for many years and are so steeped in and beloved of the meditation tradition that they believe that that's enough to enable them to teach it, because they've seen so many teachers and they've received so many benefits. And why is that a barrier? Because, of course, each of these are necessary components to being a good mindfulness teacher within the health service, to be a qualified therapist, to be a qualified meditation teacher, and so on. They come together. But both of the necessary components can also be barriers, because it's such a stretch for somebody really experienced as a therapist to leap that boundary, and it's quite a stretch for somebody who's done many retreats to leap into the teaching role. And of course, we wouldn't expect, if you've seen a great violinist perform many times, it doesn't necessarily allow you to play the violin. I wish it did. It'd be so good, wouldn't it? You just go to the proms, and at the end of a season of proms, you can play the violin. So these are very difficult. And as John Kabat-Zinn has said, readiness to teach is a lifelong koan. We don't know what readiness to teach consists of. We know when we see it what a good teacher is, but how to get people there. But then that's no different from school teaching, because most of us experienced people that said all the same things in the class to us, whether it was classics or maths or whatever, and some of them are really good teachers. They go, just look at you, and there'll be silence. And others said the same things, but everybody rioted and threw bits of paper around and flinked inkwells at people, and they just couldn't keep order. What is it about a good teacher? We just don't know. So it is a lifelong koan, but I think you're absolutely right to put your finger on it, that there's a job to be done to ensure that people who are teaching an 8-week course in a secular context don't lose their connection with the ground, with the source. And so we recommend in training guidelines that people always go on regular retreats. That's an essential part of maintaining your sort of standing as a teacher. Mm.
Can I just add something to that, which I think, in many senses, I feel great compassion for those who are trying to do it in the more secular context, because in a way it's a big ask to suddenly be propelled in front of a group of people and to actually have to deliver something that, you know, for example, most of the teachers I teach with the Gaia House have been involved for 30, 40 years in this stuff, and we're absolutely steeped in it in this way. And yet this isn't the case with a lot of mindfulness teachers. I mean, those within this more secular context, probably some of them, you know, even if they're long-term practitioners, probably 15, 20 years is probably the most they've been doing as practitioners. And a lot more, obviously, of a much, much shallower range of experience. I think any teacher, and I see this within the more Buddhist world, within Gaia House and other Dharma centres as well, actually improves with age. And I say that because it improves with experience. The more experience you have, the more you engage in your own meditation, the more you engage, you know, for example, in the contemplation and thinking about a lot of this material, the better you become as a teacher. But you've got to be passionate about it. You really have to be passionate about what you're trying to convey. Now, I think we're making a big ask of people who are coming into a different world, probably from a therapy background. And actually, we're asking them really to be practitioners themselves, to be better teachers. Mm. And that's the huge part of it, is actually becoming really experienced practitioners, so that when, for example, an inquiry is made at the end, that it's actually, the responses are actually coming from their experience, just like it would in a one-to-one interview with a teacher at Gaia House, for example. Hopefully it's connecting with their experience, and that's why they can offer some kind of guidance around the issue, whatever it is.
There was there's a few hands, so let's try and get two or three questions in this time, so we can hear from all you. There's a gentleman in the second row, and then there's a lady in the front, and then after one, there's two. Okay, someone right at the back. We'll try and get round all of you.
First of all, I just want to say, very inspired by the work that you were doing. Serious concerns about the clinical application of meditation techniques, especially when you might take it to the next step and ramp up meditation to a sort of a higher intensity, where one question I have mentioned the Dr. Yana's, but also there are side effects that in some ways mirror quite serious mental health problems that one might experience in altered states, the hallucinations, things that in the Indian tradition people refer to as kundalini. These aren't necessarily the aim of the practice, but they're in some ways quite hard to avoid if you're practicing at a high level of intensity. And particularly thinking about people who started practicing meditation in order to find a way out of serious mental health problems, I'm just concerned, how do you guide people through these sorts of stages? How do you protect them if these are stages they're going into, or should there be sort of, in a way, kind of particular warnings that certain people with prior history of mental health problems maybe shouldn't be practicing more than, say, a few minutes a day and not going to intensive retreats, for example? Mm-hmm.
There were some questions in. Oh, there was a lady in the front, wasn't there? Yeah, in the green scarf, yeah. If you could hand the microphone forward.
So you want to take a couple of questions and then answer them together?
Yeah.
So my question is around picking up on what the gentleman over here said about generosity first, morality second, and mental training third. And I know, John, Mark, you kind of mentioned this a little bit in passing, but I have quite a sort of an interest in, are we misrepresenting the whole impact of the Buddhist training by focusing so much on mindfulness and the mental patterns? And is it possible, or is there already been research done into looking at what the impact is if we added in some of the morality using the precepts, and also encouraging people just in simple acts of generosity, rather than, and to some extent, I guess, that some teachers may be doing, but if we actively put generosity into practice and really work with the precepts the way we do on retreat, would that be something that was amenable to research?
There were a couple of questions over in that direction. There's a lady right at the back. There was another question somewhere over there.
I was interested in actually what you were saying about self-compassion earlier, and particularly as more and more research has been done about friendliness and compassion in general, how will that then impact on the NBCT as it's currently taught? What, you know, what mechanisms are there for it to evolve, and how do you see that happening? And how does that mesh with the fact that most guidelines are actually quite tight, really, the way in which things get improved by now? I'm just interested in that process.
Mark, do you want to tackle some of those?
Yeah. Well, if we start with nice, the NICE guidelines are quite tight. Well, they're tight in one respect, and that is that they will tend to approve any technique if it's been evaluated in the United Kingdom and has at least two trials to show that it's effective. That then means that there's a slight disadvantage if there are trials done outside the United Kingdom population or haven't yet got two trials. So that's one way it's tight. However, once a technique is expressed within NICE, then it will vary, it will be allowed to vary within itself. So cognitive behaviour therapy, for example, does vary there is quite a lot of latitude for cognitive therapy, and so that will vary. So NICE doesn't tie us down. But the second question about adding compassion in, we could do, except it was interesting that the self-compassion data that I was talking about was a standard MBCT without any specific loving kindness, any karuna practices or metta practices being deliberately. And part, we took the decision not to put those in because they can go quite wrong, actually, for people who have a history of depression, because they have a sort of aversion to compassion, as Paul Gilbert has described, which can take some specific dealing with in therapy and might not be dealt with in the group, so that they are actually switched off by words like, you know, kind and compassionate, unless it's handled very carefully and much more, I think, on an individual basis. But also, we were wary of mixing something which for many people feels either a bit like praying or a bit like wishing for another state. So kindness, loving kindness or kindness practice or friendliness practices are not actually that. They're not actually about trying to generate a feeling. And they're not about can I be in a different state from the one I'm in? But nevertheless, in an 8-week course, you've got to choose the moment where that is. And we felt that compassion and kindness was best expressed in the teacher, not in specific practices. But that's not to say there's a lot of research going out now with Barbara Fredrickson on loving kindness meditation in the United States. Really precise work showing that there's a great deal. It's not just about positive psychology. There's a lot of great things going on there. So I think that's it's a work in progress, I think. And it will, I'm sure, influence the second, third generation of MBCT. The generosity, are we misrepresenting the foundational traditions, which is, as I understand it, your question. I think there may be, there's not a deliberate misrepresentation, but I think there's bound to be some missing out of some components when you put something in a secular context and in a modern NHS component in a Western culture. The interesting thing is, however, that when I teach in Asia, the interest in this from people in the place from which this came is intense, because they often say that they have not been ever taught how this extraordinarily large tradition can be put into a form that can be delivered in their, what they want to have is a modern healthcare system. People don't think of using what they do in the temple actually in the healthcare system. So it's extraordinary to be able to give a gift back to Taiwan and China and Hong Kong and India and Vietnam, where actually it's part of their tradition, but it's so much part of the tradition that actually putting it in a form that has evidence behind it, which they need to do for their government, which are tend to be secular governments, who won't think temple worship is good for you from the point of view of, you know, that's not part of what they do. So I think there's a sort of a sense of the wisdom of skillful means here, that we need to be aware of the contact with the foundational tradition and the discipline of that, but also be aware of the discipline we get from the knowledge of what psychological conditions, how they manifest and how they can be addressed, which brings me to the first point, with the really good point about what about altered states of consciousness and psychosis and so on. And I think the point that you made was a really good one, that there are real experts, for example, like Paul Chadwick, who has had many years' experience, he's now at the Institute of Psychiatry, many years' experience in dealing with standard psychotherapy with people who hear voices, people who have altered states of consciousness, people who have psychotic breakdowns, and who have still got symptoms. He's also a meditator, and when the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy came out, he thought, well, I wonder whether this might be helpful for some of my patients, but he's insisting on 10-minute maximum, and for people who hear voices, the guidance has to be fairly continuous, because if you leave a gap, all people hear are the voices. But people are able to do it. He has 1.5-hour classes of about 10 people, and they do 2 10-minute sittings in that. And then they offered the tapes to do it at home if they want to. There's nothing compulsion about the home practice at all. They want to carry this on. But to see the people, he's got some DVDs of people talking about how difficult it was to let go of trying to control their voices, and to how threatening that was, but how they managed to learn to do it is quite extraordinary. So yeah, you have to be very careful about saying people wanting to ramp up and then go to retreats. And I think, and I wouldn't teach that particular client group. I would go and get supervision from Paul if somebody came to me with that sort of problem, because I'm not that, you know, a psychologist who has experience of that. I think that's one of the examples in which you need 20 or 30 years' experience as a psychologist dealing with people with psychotic experiences before you then use it for this. So there's the connection with the foundational tradition and the connection with the foundational psychology as well.
Yeah, I'll just make some short responses to these questions, particularly the first one, which is actually it's part of our job in what we're doing in a sense, trying to train people who are going to then become teachers to what to look out for in terms of, for example, altered states and experience, which actually in the standard MBCT won't be talked about in the protocol. I mean, a classic one that comes to mind, for example, is what's, you know, on the basis of just entry into access concentration, for example, and the signs often that come, sometimes these can be auditory signs and they can be particularly visual signs. And, you know, I've spoken to a few people who've been in MBCT training who didn't know what these were. You know, literally one lady said to me that she ducked when she got this particular image coming straight at her. You know, because she hadn't been spoken about it. So I think it's partly our job as you know, those like myself, and there are some others, obviously, particularly from Guy House, who are involved in this training of MBCT teachers, to make sure that they're aware of these kinds of occurrences that can happen in meditative states. I think the other point is very useful is actually knowing that these meditations aren't... have to be absolutely strictly adhered to. There's actually within the meditational, the way of teaching meditation in the tradition, there's a lot of experimentation, and people are encouraged to experiment, and often a lot of what I call guidance in saying, actually don't do that. Mm. You know? For example, metta practice, as Mark indicated, is, you know, for certain categories of people is basically contraindicated. You know, and in a meditational situation, if somebody came on a meta retreat who had those contraindications, I'd be saying, actually, go away and do something different. You know, even though you're on a meta retreat, because you know, there isn't one size fits all with this, and I think we have to become very, very aware of this. It's not one size fits all, and a lot of that in the traditional context goes on in one-to-one guidance. because people are adjusting what they're doing, perhaps making more of an emphasis on walking meditation, more of an emphasis on compassion for those who it's indicated for, and so on and so forth. So I think there's a lot of that, of tailoring it to the person. Now, with an 8-week manualized course, it's impossible to do that in such a way to do that. So you have to kind of make those who are going to be teaching as aware as possible of the contraindications. Now, of course, there is a standard interview that's done, or a pre-class interview with most of this, where some of these elements could be picked up and say, actually, perhaps this is not the right time for you at this moment in time. Just dealing with the question about generosity and these other elements of the tradition, these are all ways of inclining the mind in our lives. And it's interesting, isn't it, that generosity within Buddhist cultures is actually the key most virtue. And this doesn't mean generosity in material things. People tend to think it's just about material stuff. So it's partly about that. But the generosity is one of spirit. And it shows itself in the gift. I mean, actually, standardly, traditionally, the gift is basically three forms. There's the gift of materiality. That's considered to be the lowest gift, actually. There is the gift of friendship. And then finally, there's the gift of the Dharma itself, the gift of the teaching, which is considered to be the greatest gift, because that can really help people. So when we start talking about generosity, I think it's more about this generosity of spirit, the second point that I think we're really trying to encourage, because it's encouraging interaction with people in a much, much more generous way, perhaps in a friendlier way. Now, I think a lot of this, and I've perhaps reversed by some of my attitudes towards this as I've been working with Mark and others here, is actually I think a lot of this is implicit. And that really heartens me, that actually it's coming across in an implicit way. We're not having to finger wag and say to people, actually you've got to go out and be generous, and you've got to go out and do this. That actually they start to learn it. And actually, I'm not that surprised, really, that that happens, because within the tradition, when you genuinely touch moments of mindfulness, a lot of it's just attention that we're engaging in. But when you genuinely touch moments of mindfulness, it says within the tradition, particularly within some of the texts, that when you touch that, it brings in all of the virtues. Mm-hmm. So you get generosity, you get kindness, you get compassion. This is very much a perspective from the psychological literature, that all of these are activated when you hit a genuine moment of mindfulness. So I'm coming now to the persuasion that these are important, and perhaps we have to make those people who are teaching this aware of it, but I think within the protocol, I think it's there implicitly.
More questions? Three, I think.
Hi there. I'm interested in how, in terms of increasing essentially secular mindfulness in society, just from looking around at my friends and my family and just seeing how much I think it could benefit people, essentially. And what I'm interested in is, you talked about the problems of associating it with action for happiness and things, but in terms of MBCT and MBSR, it's based in some sense on a deficit. So I'm interested in how it can be promoted in society in a way that works. I know with your book, Finding Peace in a Frantic World, maybe that's sort of a move in that direction, because it's sort of about peace. But is there a way that it can be, because basically I work in schools, and I'm sort of doing a bit of teaching in schools, and I think, we want it in schools, we want it in places like that, and it needs to be marketed in a way that it's not seen as there's something wrong with me to be doing it. So is there a way for that to happen without it being sort of a negative sort of seen the association with happiness or I'm not really sure. Yeah. Mm.
Slightly related question. I have a great thought that the sessions on the NHS now. But when I attended an 8-week group, I felt a tension between the continual instruction that anyone who meditates has to deal with, to not try to achieve a particular state, and indeed the tension that we have in the West to not worry about doing it right. But the clinical framework of you're here to feel better. And it's something that a lot of people in the group struggled with in terms of the teaching, because they were saying, but you know, we, in various ways they were saying, we come to stop things progression groups. And it felt like there almost wasn't yet a way of addressing that within that context. In my house, there are ways of addressing that, but it's very subtle. And I wondered how much that had been an issue in the eight week course.
There was one lady. Yeah.
Last week I was at the very good retreat, which was led by John Peacock and spiritual development. And I'm a psychologist, and I was very aware, perhaps for the first time, because there was a lot of Buddhist teaching, of what seemed like a real culture or paradigm difference in terms of the way that I'm used to receiving teaching, in terms of it, the amount of, or the approach of kind of receiving teaching, rather than kind of interacting with it in a perhaps what I would consider more critical or challenging way. I found that interesting but quite difficult. But what I'm wondering is how the two of you see this discussion between Buddhism and Western psychology evolving in the next 5 to 10 years, maybe. What is it that is it worth to end if we follow up?
Yeah,
John. Well, perhaps I'll start with that question. I think there are two different ways of expressing things, and it's very much, I think that's the case. And we've got to remember that for example, the teaching you heard last week is very much from this Buddhist tradition. It's put in traditional ways and the psychological understandings of that early tradition. And Christina, myself, particularly had lots of experience in the East, so it's influenced by our teachers as well and the way that we were taught. However, what I find so fascinating, and I think this is partly addressing the last part of your question, what I find so interesting is, I've had this happen to me so many times when we've been teaching together with some of our other colleagues, and they say, isn't that just like something in CBT? And then they'll explain. And basically what we're using is a similar psychological understanding, but we're using very different language. I think what we're in the early stages of, and I hope this develops much, much more, is finding a language of commonality, where it's not reducing one to the other. I don't think that's a good idea, trying to say, well, actually Buddhism is just Western psychology in a different form and vice versa. But actually trying to develop a common language where there is a much greater congruence of understanding of what is actually going on in psychological processes. Because I do, I would say this, wouldn't I? I mean, I do think there's a tremendous amount of real untapped understanding in early Buddhist materials, but it needs a language in which to translate it. And I'm not talking about just the literal physical translation from the original languages, but even a retranslation of that into the languages of contemporary idioms such as psychology, which will make it much more approachable. I won't say always assimilable, because I think sometimes it offers challenges which aren't directly assimilable into those Western psychological models. What I would like to see occurring is a greater sense of dialogue between these two traditions, and perhaps a developing language which is, I'd say, sharing something here. I find that that's very important in this for this really this meeting between a 2,500-year-old tradition and this relatively recent thing to really bear fruit, because I think there's a lot within this tradition that actually even at this stage I can't think of putting in ways of language which would make it accessible enough to people within the Western psychological tradition to be able to readily take that up. However, I think this is the big part of it, is the where this commonality is really going to come from, I think, is actually from people doing the practice, not just talking about it. You know, from people like yourselves coming on retreat, experiencing the difficulties actually that clients are going to go through. Obviously, in a far lesser sense in many ways, because the time spans are not so great in terms of, you know, you're not being asked to keep silent for 7 days or 8 days or 9 days or whatever it is. But I think you are going to have that sense of commonality of experience as well. And I think that is what's important. That's where the language really has to arise from, out of that understanding of experience itself. Now, at this stage, I think we have different ways of languaging that. I think there can be much more of a congruence of coming together of that language. That's where I'd like to see things go in the next, you know, 5, 10 years or whatever, personally. Well, to just address the first question. Happiness is a really weird word, isn't it? I'm never sure quite what it means. In fact, these days in teaching, you know, even within Buddhist context, it's a word I tend to avoid, because it's not actually one the Buddha particularly uses himself. He uses the language of equanimity and the language of contentment. Because what he's fundamentally pointing to is not pathologies, unless you want to, as I said in my kind of brief talk, unless you want to see the whole of life as a pathology in a way, because it's a pathology of desire and discontentment that's there, wanting things to be different from the way that they are. And really that is the common thread, I think. It's just that in the tradition overall, as opposed to just purely the secular mindfulness, it's looking at how we deal with those big senses of discontentment, how we come to a more equanimous position. Now, equanimity here isn't kind of a bovine putting up with things. You know, equanimity here is an active engagement with life's difficulties, but also with life's joys. And I think, in a way, that's what we're saying. Actually, life is a bundle, and it comes to us as a mixed bundle, particularly when you're a teenager and driven by hormones and all the rest of it. You know, it comes as a mixed bundle, and you know, it's how do you deal with that mixed bundle without just wanting to push some stuff away and just automatically get caught up with the other stuff. If you want to see that as a pathology, well, that's the Buddhist pathology. That's exactly what's going on for all of us in different ways. And I think the very individual, specific pathologies are actually sort of manifestations of that bigger sense of wanting something and pushing something away. And so what we're moving into is a language of equanimity and a language of contentment. And actually the Buddha's equation is, if you want to talk about happiness, actually happiness is simply contentment with the way things are and the way things are coming to you. That's really what it's about.
Yeah, I think I'd just add a couple of things to that and perhaps pick up the schools and the issue about that, and the issue also about the irony of saying, of going to a group because you're depressed and then being told, well, don't have any goals here. Watch out for those goals. Just a word on the schools. I think there is an issue about how do we present something not always in a deficit way. And the Mindfulness in Schools organisation that Chris Cullen and Richard Bennett and some people here are involved with, they have a regular series of meetings. They've got a meeting here in March, the 27th, where John Kabat-Zinn is speaking, actually in this very building. If you want to know more, go to the mindfulnessinschools.org website, and you'll see evidence about that day. And they are, yes, they're dealing with that. In the schools programme, you've got to satisfy not just the pupils, but their parents and their headmaster and their headmistress and their teachers. So there's a lot of different constituency, and therefore the vocabulary is very often about attention,
about resilience, sometimes about sport. The .B program that Chris Cullen and Richard Burnett and others have been putting together talks about, you know, meditation rather than just meditation, and meditations you do in bed. And it talks about sending text messages to each other to say, I'm thinking of you. This .B means pause, stop, take a breath. And to hear 15-year-old boys talk about how moved they are to get these things is quite incredible. So I think there is something, there's a job to be done, but they're doing a fantastic job in mindfulness in schools. That's all one word, by the way, when you put it into the web. This irony, though, of actually inviting people to come to, as it were, apparently solve a problem, is a big irony. It's one of the paradoxes, but it's the paradox that we all do when we meditate, isn't it? The big paradox is we're already where we need to be, so why do we need to practice? So, well, one answer is we practice to get out of our own way. And I love the fact that meditation is a translation of a word which means cultivation, from the agrarian, from the cultivating a garden. And so the analogy I usually use is it's like planting seeds. And of course, it's not my analogy, it's been used for generations. But actually, when you plant seeds, you're doing it in expectation you'll have flowers or something to eat. But you don't dig them up every day to see if they're growing yet. I once dug up my dead hamster to see if it had gone to heaven. Such was my religious belief. It hadn't gone to heaven. But I didn't do it again. There is a sense that I know that my five-year-old grandson wants to dig up his seeds to see if they're growing. And actually, when we come to an eight-week class, we're asking people, yeah, you've planted seeds, they may take time to grow, so don't keep digging them up, so don't worry every day about things. But people, time and time again, say, something changed for me. And that might happen for you, but we can't say exactly what it'll be, so let's stay open to that. But it's worth doing it, yeah.
Doesn't that conflict with the kind of whole evidence-based approach to the NHS? That's what I'm curious about. Like, once this goes broader and wider across the country, aren't GPs saying, well, this patient isn't tested yet?
Yeah, fortunately, the evidence-based NHS, they just look in the papers and see whether it works in total. In other words, they're interested in whether there's a good crop, not in how the farmer did it. So actually, we just have to be the responsible farmer and let other people worry about whether the crop yield is okay.
Great. Well, I think that's been a fascinating conversation. I'm sure all of you agree that we're very, very grateful to both John and Mark. I don't know if I need to say anything about Dana. Do I? No? Sorry? Yeah. Am I leaving it here? Yeah.
Just to say a quick word about Dana. People have already mentioned generosity, and part of this tradition has always been to offer the teachings freely. On the cost of coming tonight, it's just paid for the organisation. But if you'd like to show your generosity to Mark and John, there is a box outside where you can make donations there, and that will go to the Oxford Centre for Mindfulness to support people who aren't able to pay for the various programmes they put on there. So if you'd like to show your generosity, I'm sure it would be much appreciated.
And thank you very much to all of you and all of your contributions, and I very much hope it's proved as inspiring as I believe it has for me. Thank you. Mm-hmm.